Hello, and welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. Just a quick update on the status of the recent LQ code upgrade. Things have been going great, although we do continue to have to clean up some minor bugs here and there that we found. The forums at this point should be extremely stable. Really, the only minor nuance we ran into was that due to some of the changes in the code, some people were continually getting logged out, and it ended up being due to a cookie conflict with the old setup. So if you are still experiencing that problem, there is a thread in the forums about a step-by-step procedure. But basically, if you just delete all the old LQ cookies and re-log in, everything should be fine. Some of the other sections of the site, such as the HCL and reviews, we've ran into a couple more minor problems than with the forums. We just did correct some of those just about 10 minutes ago, and we are working on correcting the rest. In the meantime, if you do notice any problems or bugs, issues you think should be corrected, or even if you just have a feature request, do please report it in the LQ Bug Tracker, which is a new part of the site that allows us to track feature requests, track bug requests, so you can know the status of them as we close them and see what's open. So you probably do want to search before submitting one, but the bug tracker should really help us get a better handle on, you know, fixing bugs and tracking down bugs, and also keeping track of feature requests, which we really do appreciate. Another quick update on the code upgrade is the article section, which did not go live immediately with the original change in code, is now live, and the first article actually has been posted. So go take a look at that and see who the first member to post an article to the article section was. I really do appreciate it. And once again, thanks to Ray, who has agreed to be the official LQ editor for now. He's been approving both the articles and proofreading the Linux answers, and we just approved a whole bunch of tutorials yesterday in addition to the articles, so you can check that out. Next, I'm often asked how members can help LQ. It's something that I get emailed and I get posts about, and just a common reoccurring question that I do get. So I went ahead and made a quick post about how you can help. And as the post said, and I'll reiterate here, we are always looking for volunteers in a variety of things, from people to write articles, to people to write tutorials or Linux answers, people to review distros, people that are interested in adding their hardware to the HCL, and we even had someone recently volunteer to help approve the HCL entries, so that should be getting much quicker than it had been. People that are interested in helping with the LQ Wiki. And with the LQ Wiki, that can really be anything from writing completely new content to editing existing content to even just correcting grammar or spelling and cleaning things up, which means you don't have to be extremely technical in that regard. We're also always looking for members interested in helping with the zero reply threads. And one thing to remember there is that you can now actually do an arbitrary search and make the fact that the thread has zero replies a search quantifier. So if you consider yourself an expert in any particular topic, you can actually search for threads in that topic that have zero replies, which really is a fantastic new feature, I think. That's a couple examples, but really there's much, much more. So if you think you have a specific skill that we would benefit from, don't hesitate to contact us. We really do appreciate it. And the next story I have isn't really directly LQ related, but it's also definitely not general news, so I'll cover it here. It's a commentary on an article that Jeremy Zawadny had posted to his blog entitled, You Never Forget Your First Web Server. I thought it was a fantastic post that it also brought me back, and I remember mine quite well, so I figured I'd run over it here quick, because it was my first web server was actually the first web server ever that ran LQ. I was a dual Pentium Pro 180 with the Intel PR440 FX board, which I know is a favorite of Finn, our hardware guy at LQ. And it was the first machine to run LQ. I think I had it online as a dedicated machine in about 99, although LQ didn't officially go live until 2000. I know the very first install on that box was Red Hat 5.2, although by the time LQ went live, I think we were at 6.1 of Red Hat. As Jeremy mentioned, you know, 5-6 years ago, you actually upgraded machines as opposed to now, you with servers especially, you pretty much never upgrade them. You just replace them after a couple of years. I remember, for example, one time taking LQ down for probably a good 2 hours while we moved from the machine's original single IDE drive to two SCSI drives and installed an Adaptec PCI controller. And the drives were Seagate Cheetahs, I remember. And that was a kind of a big step for us to get off that single IDE drive. And I know at one point I also brought down the site, probably for only about 15 minutes, to upgrade the memory. And I think we went up to a gig at that point. At one point in the original machine, which was the only machine ever to serve LQ that wasn't a rack mount, I even installed this little LCD, which is kind of funny. And I posted a picture of that up on my blog just so you could check it out. It's kind of different. It's not something that you'll see all the time. Ironically, that original machine, along with the second machine to serve LQ, are sitting 2 feet away from my desk in the corner there. So it's kind of interesting to look back and see what used to serve the site as opposed to what serves the site now. And LQ definitely has come a long way in that regard. Lastly, an astute listener noticed that currently this podcast and my blog at times have pretty similar content. And at this point, that really is just a result of time constraints. From this point on, slowly moving forward, you will notice that the content is going to diverge quite a bit, to the point that in the end, I'd like to see probably about 80% disparate content between the two, with only the stories I consider really important making both. I do realize that some people read my blog and listen to the podcast, so they're getting a little duplication. I always do try to add at least something a little bit different, whether it's an update or a different aspect of the story, depending on whether I did it in the podcast first or the blog first. But I do realize that, good eye, and it is something that definitely I anticipate will be changing in the near future. Now on to the news. The first story I have for you is Linux/Unix vulnerabilities outnumber Microsoft Windows 3-1. And this story was just a fantastic example of numbers not meaning anything if you're just throwing things around. The numbers are, as I mentioned in my blog, less than useless. They're just plain still silly and stupid, really. Now, the original stats are from the United States CERT site, but the fantastic headline, which mentions the 3-1 ratio, is from an Information Week article. Here's a quote from the article. Tallies kept by the U.S. Government Computer Security Group show that Linux and Unix operating systems faced nearly 3 times the number of vulnerabilities in 2005 that did Microsoft's often maligned Windows. In the U.S. CERT, and third is United States Computer Emergency Readiness Team, year-end vulnerability summary, Linux/Unix accounted for a whopping 2,328 vulnerabilities, about 45% of the 5,198 total. End quote. So before you end up getting worried here, let's just take a closer look at what these numbers actually mean. Now first, for some reason that I don't quite understand here, they're lumping Linux, and by Linux it's pretty much every distro, Unix, and in this, they mention HPUX, they mention AIX, they mention quite a few different Unix variants, also including Solaris, and OS X into one single group. And then they're comparing that to a product put out by a single vendor. So pretty much this would be like lumping all the upper-end cars, say Lexus, BMW, Toyota, Honda, Infiniti, Porsche, Volkswagen, Saab, Volvo, etc., into a single group, and then comparing them to Chevy, which I believe is the largest auto manufacturer in the U.S., and then saying that Chevys are safer. And I can't see that any realistic auto magazine would do something like this. But that's not all, though. It really does get worse from there. They not only include things that are in no way related to the OS, and just going through a few of these, they cover GNU, GNATS, they cover some product that I'm not ever even have heard of, which is Yokohiro Matsumoto Ruby. They include Yapig, another product I haven't heard of, but clearly things that are absolutely in no way related to the OS and don't, as far as I can tell, come by default installed in any distribution, and certainly not any of the major ones. But they're also including multiple reports from different Unix vendors about the same exact issue as completely different issues. So BZIP, for example, was counted at least 10 times, I noticed, which is just completely absurd. Now, the big problem with this article, since it wasn't such a major publication and the original numbers came from a U.S. government site, is that if someone just gave a cursory glance to the numbers or to the headlines, they might actually believe this asinine results. But beyond the stupidity of the numbers, there's a bigger issue here. Security issues in open source software actually get spotted and fixed on a regular basis, and that's a good thing. It makes you more secure. The security by obscurity and closed source aspect of Microsoft Windows means that a bug is only acknowledged and then fixed when Microsoft, and if Microsoft, decides to do that. So as an example, you might have remembered there was a ping/JPEG vulnerability announced a couple of years ago in the various Unix variants. Those are just getting fixed in Windows now, and open source addressed them, like I said, in about 2003. So you decide what's more secure there. Would you rather have things reported and fixed, or not reported, or reported years later? So the moral of the story here is always look into the numbers you're given, as opposed to just reading headlines, especially headlines that are clearly meant to be sensational and to sell. Next story I have is Google Pack released. Now, contrary to the many rumors that were swirling around, Google did not announce a cheap PC at CES, and the rumor had been that they were going to do something I often saw a Walmart included in the rumors, where it was a $100 to $200 kind of PC that would, it looked to compete with Media Center, but the details were a bit sketchy and definitely varied widely depending on the article that you read. Now, what they did announce is called Google Pack. Now, I'm not sure, but this one does not make all that much sense to me. Now, we're going to put aside the fact that Google Pack is only available for Windows XP and requires administrative privileges in XP. Now, a cobbled-together mix of unrelated software, some which have, in my opinion, questionable stability, from a disparate variety of vendors with seemingly no integration, seems like an uncharacteristically poor decision for Google. Now, we add to that the fact that the Norton antivirus that comes with it is actually a time-limited product, and it just gets even stranger. Basically, how they ship Norton was you get 6 free months of virus definition updates, which is similar to how the OEM version of Symantec works. And after that, you either have to pay for them or you just don't get updates, which in an antivirus product, if you don't get definition updates, you might as well not have one installed. Now, as I mentioned just a second ago, it really does seem like a kind of unrelated grouping of products. Some products focus on certain segments like consumers, some seem to focus on other segments, so it does very much seem cobbled together. Now, Firefox is one great decision that they put in here. The one that surprised me is that Game is not in there, and they recently hired the lead developer of the project, but Google Talk is included in the base install of the Google Pack, and then Trillion is in the optional packs. Why Game wasn't in there, I'm not quite sure. My question here is, what is the vision for this product? What does it do for Google, and more importantly, what really does it do for the consumer? And that's what I just have no idea about that. And what's even worse than that is, this would seem to really help one of their biggest competitors, Microsoft, in multiple ways. You know, it's pretty much seems to me almost like a service pack or an upgrade to Windows, which would lead me to believe that they're encouraging people to use Windows. So we'll see how the Google Pack kind of morphs in the future and what it turns into. This is just a first release, so it might have a longer term vision that I'm just not seeing, but I would be interested to get your feedback on this one. Next story, Sun and Apple almost merged 3 times. And that was according to Bill Joy, and that was in a Register article. If you're not familiar with Bill Joy, I definitely encourage you to look him up. He's definitely, you know, legendary in this industry and has contributed just a ton. So I'll leave that as an exercise to the listener. So there are some definite similarities here between these two companies, Apple and Sun. Both produce higher cost, you know, slick products. And for Apple, I think slick means more the styling and the look and they're cool or whatever. For Sun, slick means something different. It's more on the server end, and some of the things they do to make their hardware bulletproof really is slick, although not in a styling kind of way. But you do definitely pay a premium for both of their products. And then I think a well-deserved premium. Now, both are California-based, and both clearly have a focus on Unix-related technologies, whether it be Solaris or, you know, the Darwin-based OS X. Now, the kind of differences, and where you would think they're actually complementary here, is that Apple has a strong desktop showing and is trying to get into the server market, while Sun has a strong server showing and has tried multiple times, usually without any amount of success, to get into the desktop market. So there's obviously some places where these companies would seem to fit together very well. Now there's one huge and possibly unsurmountable problem that I do see as a prevention for these two companies merging. Steve Jobs and Scott McNeely are both extremely high-profile CEOs that have lengthy ties to their respective companies. You know, obviously, they're both founders, in fact, so they're both inextricably, I think, tied to the respective companies' histories. So who would the CEO of this new company be? And I think it's also clear that Steve and Scott have slightly differing opinions on where the direction of the company should be. So what direction would this new company follow? I don't think that either of these two guys are ready to split any of the limelight. So I just, the power struggle that would ensue, it seems like it would be a bad idea. Additionally, having to maintain two Unix-based operating systems would be a huge expense, but really, if they got rid of either one of them, they would alienate so many people that it just wouldn't be worth doing. So in the end, I just can't see it happening, although these days you never do know. It just seems extremely unlikely. The last story I have for you is the use of Linux at NASA. And we get quite a different perspective on Linux use here from the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, also known as JPL, which is based in Pasadena. Now, contrary to what you'll almost always see anywhere else, they use and love Linux on the desktop, but don't consider it in any way viable for the server. Here's a quote from the article. "Our personal view is that Linux, period, is only for the desktop. We don't run our main servers on Linux because there are too many flaws in the main Linux kernel," end quote. Now, I have to admit that Linux stability is not really where it needs to be in a very certain context for some very specific applications. Now, I'm not talking here about the kind of stability that involves crashes. Although I do see more crashes than I'd like to see, realistically, Linux is rock-solid stable if you configure it correctly on known good hardware with a known good configuration. What I'm talking about here is kind of from a life cycle standpoint, where a company like NASA, or a government agency, I guess, like NASA, wants to install something and have it work and work for, we're talking a decade here, without any amount of upgrades. And they mentioned that they're still on Solaris 8, which is still supported from Sun and is ancient at this point, pretty much. Now, RHEL and SLES, which are Red Hat Enterprise Linux and SUSE Linux Enterprise, respectively, have done a ton in this regard. But they are both relatively new, and they still have a little to learn in this area. Now, I think there is pretty much a definite chance that they both are going to get where they need to be. It's just a matter of time, and especially Red Hat is still a younger company in a lot of ways, and especially in the enterprise segment, it's something they moved to later in the company's history. Novell probably has a little more experience there, but a product that isn't quite as mature as Red Hat. So they're both growing, they're both learning. I think it's fantastic that we have two very good vendors in the space, and I think they're even learning from each other. And one great thing about the enterprise Linux vendors that you can see already is that they're learning from each other and they're sharing technologies with each other, so things are advancing at just an extremely fast pace. One place you can example you can notice this is that Red Hat just took up Xen, which came from Novell. There's not a lot of not invented here in this space, where if you look at a company like Sun, they're notorious for not invented here mentality. And another great thing, and this is just something that I think is truly exceptional about Linux, is that it's scaling in two almost diametrically opposed directions. One being its move towards big iron and mainframes and just astronomically large machines, kind of the things that we're talking about in this that NASA would be interested in. And on the other side, into the embedded space, where we're talking cell phones and things of that nature. But it's doing it not only at the same time, but it's doing a good job in both directions. And that is truly awesome, and I think really where a lot of the power in Linux comes from. So that is all I have for now, but thanks for listening. And remember, if you like the LQ podcast, please head over to podcastalley.com and vote for us. Thanks.